sacrilege to remove the wine from the ceremony, and besides, taking the wine out of the holy context would surely untransubstantiate it, turning it back into ordinary wine. There is really only one action you can take to demonstrate this belief. You can say that you believe it over and over, as fervently as the occasion demands. This topic is broached in a telling way in Dominus Iesus, on the unicity and salvific universality of Jesus Christ and the Church, a declaration written by Cardinal Ratzinger, who later was elected Pope Benedict XVI, and ratified by Pope John Paul II at a plenary session on June 16, 2000. Again and again this document specifies what faithful Catholics must firmly believe. But at several points the declaration shifts idiom and speaks of what the Catholic faithful are required to profess. As a professor myself, I find the use of this verb irresistible. What is commonly referred to as religious belief or religious conviction might less misleadingly be called religious professing. Unlike academic professors, religious professors, not just priests, but all the faithful, may not either understand or believe what they are professing. They are just professing, because that is the best they can do, and they are required to profess. Cardinal Ratzinger cites Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Preaching the gospel is not a reason for me to boast. It is a necessity laid on me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 16. Though lip service is thus required, it is not enough. You must firmly believe what you are obliged to say. How is it possible to obey this injunction? Professing is voluntary, but belief is not. Belief, when it is distinguished from believing that some sentence expresses a truth, requires understanding, which is hard to come by, even by the experts in these matters. You can't just make yourself believe something by trying, so what are you to do? Cardinal Ratzinger's declaration offers some help on this score. Faith is the acceptance in grace of revealed truth, which makes it possible to penetrate the mystery in a way that allows us to understand it coherently. Quoting John Paul II's encyclical letter, Fides et Ratio, page 13. So you should believe this. And if you can, believing this should help you believe you do understand the mystery, even if it seems to you that you don't. And hence, do firmly believe whatever it is you profess you believe. But how do you believe this? It takes faith. Why even try? What if you personally don't happen to share the belief in the doctrine in question? Here is where the memes eye view can provide some explanation. In his original discussion of memes, Dawkins had noted this problem and its traditional solution. Many children and even some adults believe that they will suffer ghastly torments after death if they do not obey the priestly rules. The idea of hellfire is, quite simply, self-perpetuating because of its own deep psychological impact. Dawkins, 1976, page 212. If you have ever received a chain letter that warned of the terrible things that would happen to you if you failed to pass it along, you can appreciate the strategy, even if you didn't fall for it. The assurances of a trusted priest can be much more compelling. If hellfire is the stick, mystery is the carrot. The propositions to be believed ought to be baffling. As Rappaport has trenchantly put it, if postulates are to be unquestionable, it is important that they be incomprehensible. 1979, page 165. Not just counterintuitive in Boyer's technical sense of contradicting only one or two of the default assumptions of a basic category, but downright unintelligible. Prosaic assertions have no bite, and moreover they are too readily checked for accuracy. For a truly awesome and mind-teasing proposition, there is nothing that beats a paradox eagerly avowed. In a later essay, Dawkins drew attention to what we might call the inflation of creedal athleticism, the boast that my faith is so strong that I can mentally embrace a bigger paradox than you can. It is easy and non-mysterious to believe that in some symbolic or metaphorical sense the Eucharistic wine turns into the blood of Christ. The Roman Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation, however, claims far more. The whole substance of the wine is converted into the blood of Christ. The appearance of wine that remains is merely accidental. Inhering in no substance. Transubstantiation is colloquially taught as meaning that the wine literally turns into the blood of Christ. Dawkins, 1993, page 21. There are several reasons why this inflation into incomprehensibility would be an adaptation that would enhance the fitness of a meme. First, as just noted, it tends to evoke wonder and draw attention to itself. It is a veritable peacock's tail of extravagant display, and memetics would predict that something like an arms race of paradoxology should ensue when religions confront waning allegiance. Peacock's tails are finally limited by the sheer physical inability of the peacocks to carry around still larger ones, and paradoxology must hit the wall, too. People's discomfort with sheer incoherence is strong, so there are always tantalizing elements of sense-making narrative, punctuated with seriously perplexing nuggets of incomprehensibility. The anomalies give the host brain something to gnaw on, like an unresolved musical cadence, and hence something to rehearse and rehearse again and baffle themselves deliciously about. Second, as noted in Chapter 5, incomprehensibility discourages paraphrase, which can be death to meme identity, by leaving the host with no viable choice but verbatim transmission. I don't really know what Pope John Paul II meant, but I can tell you that what he said was, Jesus is the incarnate Word, a single and indivisible person. Dawkins has noted an extension or refinement of this adaptation. The meme for blind faith secures its own perpetuation by the simple unconscious expedient of discouraging rational inquiry. 1976, pages 212-213. At a time when faith-based initiatives and other such uses of the term have made faith almost synonymous in the minds of many with the term religion, as in the phrase people of all faiths, it is important to remind ourselves that not all religions have a home for the concept or anything even very close to it. The meme for faith exhibits frequency-dependent fitness. It flourishes particularly in the company of rationalistic memes. In a neighborhood with few skeptics, the meme for faith does not attract much attention, and hence tends to go dormant in minds, and hence is seldom reintroduced into the memosphere. Dennett, 1995b, page 349. Indeed, it is mainly a Christian feature, and as we recently noted, Judaism has actually encouraged vigorous intellectual debate over the meaning and even the truth of many of its holy texts. But a similar athleticism is honored in Jewish practice, as explained by a rabbi. That most of the kashrut kosher laws are divine ordinances without reason given is 100% to the point. It is very easy not to murder people, very easy. It is a little bit harder not to steal, because one is tempted occasionally, so that is not great proof that I believe in God or am fulfilling His will. But if He tells me not to have a cup of coffee with milk in it with my mincemeat and peas at lunchtime, that is a test. The only reason I am doing that is because I have been told to do so. It is doing something difficult. Guardian, July 29, 1991, quoted in Dawkins, 1993, page 22. Islam, meanwhile, obliges its faithful to stop what they are doing five times a day to pray, no matter how inconvenient or even dangerous that act of loyalty proves to be. This idea that we prove our faith by one extravagant act or another, such as choosing death over recanting an item of doctrine that we don't understand, permits us to draw a strong distinction between religious faith and the sort of faith that I, for one, have in science. My faith in the expertise of physicists like Richard Feynman, for instance, permits me to endorse, and if it comes to it, bet heavily on the truth of, a proposition that I don't understand. So far, my faith is not unlike religious faith, but I am not in the slightest bit motivated to go to my death rather than recant the formulas of physics. Watch. E doesn't equal MC squared. It doesn't. It doesn't. I was lying. So there. I feel no guilt in making this little joke, unlike people who would find it deeply difficult to utter blasphemous words or recant their creed. But isn't my faith in the truth of the propositions of quantum mechanics that I admit I don't understand a sort of religious faith in any case? Let me invent a deeply religious person, Professor Faith. to give a little speech that articulates this charge. Professor Faith wants to teach me a new word, apophatic. God is a something that is wonderful. He is an appropriate recipient of prayers, and that's about all we can say about him. My concept of God is apophatic. What, you may ask, does that mean? It means I define God as ineffable, unknowable, something beyond all human ken. Listen to what Simon Oliver, writing about Dennis Turner's recent book Faith Seeking, 2003, has to say. The God rejected by modern atheism is not the God of Orthodox pre-modern Christianity. God is not any kind of thing whose existence might be rejected in the way that one might reject the existence of Santa Claus. Turner's God, owing much to the medieval mystics, is profoundly apophatic, wholly other, and, in the end, unknowable darkness. We begin our journey into that alterity in our realization that our being is a gracious gift. Page 32. And here is Raimundo Panikkar, writing about Buddhism. The term apophatic is usually used in reference to an epistemological apophaticism, positing merely that the ultimate reality is ineffable, that human intelligence is incapable of grasping, of embracing it, although this ultimate reality itself may be represented as intelligible, even supremely intelligible, in se. A gnoseological apophaticism, then, comports an ineffability on the part of the ultimate reality only quoad nos. Buddhistic apophaticism, on the other hand, seeks to transport this ineffability to the heart of ultimate reality itself, declaring that this reality, inasmuch as its logos, its expression and communication, no longer pertains to the order of ultimate reality, but precisely to the manifestation of that order, is ineffable not merely in our regard, but as such, quoad se. Thus, Buddhistic apophaticism is an ontic apophaticism, 1989, page 14. I claim that these claims really aren't so different from what your scientists say. Physicists have come to realize that matter isn't composed of clusters of hard little spheres, atoms. Matter is much stranger than that, they acknowledge, but still they call it matter, even though they mainly know what matter isn't, not what it is. They're still calling them atoms, but they no longer think of them as, well, atomic. They've changed their conception of atoms, their conception of matter, quite radically. And if you ask them what they now think matter is, they confess that it's something of a mystery. Their concept is apophatic, too. If physicists can move from concreteness to mystery, so can theologians. I hope Professor Faith has done justice to this theme, which I have often encountered in discussion. I am not at all persuaded by it. There is a big difference between religious faith and scientific faith. What has driven the changes in concepts in physics is not just heightened skepticism from an increasingly worldly and sophisticated clientele, but a tidal wave of exquisitely detailed positive results, the sort of borne-out predictions that Feynman pointed to in defending his field. And this makes a huge difference because it gives beliefs about the truths of physics a place where the rubber meets the road, where there is more than mere professing that can be done. For instance, you can build something that depends for its safe operation on the truth of those sentences and risk your life trying to fly it to the moon. Like the folk religionists' beliefs that they should sacrifice a goat or that they are invulnerable to arrows, these are beliefs that you can act on in ways that speak louder than words. People who give away all their belongings and climb to some mountaintop in anticipation of the imminent end of the world don't just believe in belief in God, but they are the exceptions, not the rule, when it comes to religious convictions. 6. Lessons from Lebanon, the strange cases of the Druze and Kim Philby. There is still more that is systematically curious about the phenomenon that people call religious belief, but that might better be called religious professing. This is a feature that has long captivated me, while further persuading me that Hume's project of natural religion, evaluating arguments for and against the existence of God, is largely wasted effort. My interest in this feature grew out of two experiences, both of which involve events that took place in Lebanon more than 40 years ago. Though that is a sheer coincidence so far as I know. I spent some of my earliest days in Beirut, where my father, a historian of Islam, was cultural attaché and a spy for the OSS. The rhythm of the muezzins calling the faithful to prayer from the nearby minaret was my everyday experience, along with my teddy bear and toy trucks. And the beautifully haunting call never fails to send chills through me when I hear it today. But I left Beirut when I was only 5 and didn't return until 1964, when I visited my mother and sister who were living there then. We spent some time in the mountains outside Beirut in a village that was mostly Druze, with some Christians and Muslims thrown in. I asked some of the non-Druze residents of the town to tell me about the Druze religion, and this is what they said. "Oh, the Druze are a very sad lot. The first principle of the Druze religion is to lie to outsiders about their beliefs. Never tell the truth to an infidel. So you shouldn't take anything a Druze tells you as authoritative. Some of us think, in fact, that the Druze used to have a holy book, their own scripture, but they lost it. And they are so embarrassed by this that they make up all manner of solemn nonsense to keep this from coming out. You will notice that the women don't participate at all in the Druze ceremonies. That's because they couldn't keep such a secret." I heard this tale from several people who claimed to know, and I also heard it denied by a few Druze, of course. But if it was true, this would create a dilemma for any anthropologist. The usual method of questioning informants would be a hopeless wild goose chase, and if he made the ultimate sacrifice and converted to Druze himself, so as to gain entrance to the inner sanctum, he would have to admit that we on the outside shouldn't believe his scholarly treatise, What the Druze Really Believe, since it was written by a devout Druze, and everybody knows that the Druze lie. As a young philosopher, I was fascinated by this real-life version of the liar paradox. Epimenides the Cretan says that all Cretans are liars. Does he speak the truth? And also by the unmistakable echoes of another famous example in philosophy, Ludwig Wittgenstein's Beetle in the Box. In Philosophical Investigations, 1953, Wittgenstein says, "Suppose everyone had a box with something in it. We call it a beetle. No one can look into anyone else's box, and everyone says he knows what a beetle is only by looking at his beetle. Here, it would be quite possible for everyone to have something different in his box. One might even imagine such a thing constantly changing. But suppose the word beetle had a use in these people's language. If so, it would not be used as the name of a thing. The thing in the box has no place in the language game at all, not even as a something. For the box might even be empty. No, one can divide through by the thing in the box. It cancels out whatever it is." Section 293. Much has been written on Wittgenstein's beetle box, but I don't know if anybody has ever proposed an application to religious belief. In any case, it seems fantastic at first that the Druze might be an actual example of the phenomenon. Am I just inflating a mean-spirited calumny of the Druze by their neighbors to make a dubious philosophical point? Perhaps, but consider what Scott Atran has to say about his attempts as an anthropologist to write about the beliefs of the Druze. As a graduate student almost 3 decades ago, I spent some years with the Druze people in the Middle East. I wanted to learn about their religious beliefs, which appeared to weave together ideas from all the great monotheistic faiths in intriguing ways. Learning about Druze religion is a gradual process in the Socratic tradition, involving interpretation of parables in question-and-answer format. Although, as a non-Druze, I could never be formally initiated into the religion, the elders seemed to delight in my trying to understand the world as they conceived it. But every time I reached some level of awareness about a problem, Druze elders reminded me that anything said or learned beyond that point could not be discussed with uninitiated persons, including other Druze. I never did write on Druze religion and wound up with a thesis on the cognitive bases of science. 2002, page 9. It seems that we still don't know what the Druze really believe. We may begin to wonder if they themselves know. And we may also begin to wonder if it matters, which brings me to my second lesson from Lebanon. In 1951, Kim Philby, a senior officer in the British Intelligence Service, SIS, fell under suspicion of being a double agent, a highly placed traitor, working for the Soviet KGB. A secret tribunal was held by SIS, but Philby was found not guilty on the evidence presented. Although SIS had been unable to convict him, they quite reasonably refused to reinstate him to his most sensitive position, and he resigned and moved to Lebanon to work as a journalist. In 1963, a Soviet defector to London confirmed Philby's double agent role, and when the SIS went to Beirut to confront him, he fled to Moscow, where he spent the remainder of his life working for the KGB. Or did he? When Philby first showed up in Moscow, he was, apparently, suspected by the KGB of being a British plant, a triple agent, if you like. Was he, in fact? For years, a story circulated in intelligence circles to this effect. The idea was that when SIS exonerated Philby in 1951, they found a brilliant way of dealing with their delicate problem of trust. Congratulations, Kim, old chap. We always thought you were loyal to our cause, and for your next assignment we would like you to pretend to resign from SIS. Bitter over our failure to reinstate you fully, don't you see? And move to Beirut and take up a position as a journalist in exile. In due course, we intend to give you reason to flee to Moscow, where you will eventually be appreciated by your comrades because you can spill a lot of relatively innocuous insider information you already know, and we'll provide you with carefully controlled further gifts of intelligence and disinformation that the Russians will be glad to accept even when they have their doubts. Once you're in their good graces, we'd like you to start telling us everything you can about what they're up to, what questions they ask you, and so forth. Once SIS had given Philby this new assignment, their worries were over. It just didn't matter whether he was truly a British patriot pretending to be a disgruntled agent, or truly a loyal Soviet agent pretending to be a loyal British agent, pretending to be a disgruntled agent. He would behave in exactly the same ways in either case. His activities would be interpretable and predictable from either of two mirror-image intentional stance profiles. In one, he deeply believes that the British cause is worth risking his life for. And in the other, he deeply believes that he has a golden opportunity to be a hero of the Soviet Union by pretending that he deeply believes that the British cause is worth risking his life for, and so on. The Soviets, meanwhile, would no doubt draw the same inference and not bother trying to figure out if Philby was really a double agent or a triple agent or a quadruple agent. Philby, according to this story, had been deftly turned into a sort of human telephone, a mere conduit of information that both sides could exploit for whatever purposes they could dream up, relying on him to be a high-fidelity transmitter of whatever information they gave him, without worrying about where his ultimate loyalties lay. In 1980, when Philby's standing with his overseers in Moscow was improving, apparently, I was a visiting fellow at All Souls College in Oxford, and another visiting fellow at the time happened to be Sir Maurice Oldfield, the retired head of MI6, the agency responsible for counter-espionage outside Great Britain, and one of the spymasters responsible for Philby's trajectory. Sir Maurice was the model for Ian Fleming's M in the James Bond novels. One night after dinner, I asked him whether this story I had heard was true, and he replied quite testily that it was a lot of rubbish. He wished people would just let poor Philby live out his days in Moscow in peace and quiet. I replied that I was pleased to get his answer, but we both had to recognize that it was also what he would have told me had the story been true. Sir Maurice glowered and said nothing. These two stories illustrate in extreme form the fundamental problem faced by anyone intent on studying religious beliefs. It has been noted by many commentators that typical, canonical religious beliefs cannot be tested for truth. As I suggested earlier, this is as good as a defining characteristic of religious creeds. They have to be taken on faith and are not subject to scientific historical confirmation. But more than that, for this reason and others, religious belief expressions cannot really be taken at face value. The Anthropologists Craig Palmer and Lyle Stedman, 2004, page 141, quote the lament of their distinguished predecessor, the anthropologist Rodney Needham, who was frustrated in his work with the Painon in interior Borneo. I realized that I could not confidently describe their attitude to God, whether this was belief or anything else. In fact, as I had glumly to conclude, I just did not know what was their psychic attitude toward the personage in whom I had assumed they believed. Clearly, it was one thing to report the received ideas to which a people subscribed, but it was quite another matter to say what was their inner state, belief, for instance, when they expressed or entertained such ideas. If, however, an ethnographer said that people believed something when he did not actually know what was going on inside them, then surely his account of them must, it occurred to me, be very defective in quite fundamental ways. Needham, 1972, pages 1 and 2. Palmer and Stedman take this recognition by Needham to signal the need for recasting anthropological theories as accounts of religious behavior, not religious belief. While religious beliefs are not identifiable, religious behavior is, and this aspect of the human experience can be comprehended. What is needed is an explanation of this observable religious behavior that is restricted to what can be observed, page 141. They go on to say that Needham is virtually alone in realizing the profound implications of this fact about the inscrutability of religious avowal. But they themselves overlook the even more profound implication of it. The natives are in the same boat as Needham. They are just as unable to get into the inner minds of their kin and neighbors as Needham is. When it comes to interpreting religious avowals of others, everybody is an outsider. Why? Because religious avowals concern matters that are beyond observation, beyond meaningful test. So the only thing anybody can go on is religious behavior, and more specifically, the behavior of professing. A child growing up in a culture is like an anthropologist, after all, surrounded by informants whose professings stand in need of interpretation. The fact that your informants are your father and mother and speak in your mother tongue does not give you anything more than a slight circumstantial advantage over the adult anthropologist who has to rely on a string of bilingual interpreters to query the informants. And think about your own case. Weren't you ever baffled or confused about just what you were supposed to believe? You know perfectly well that you don't have privileged access to the tenets of the faith that you were raised in. I am just asking you to generalize the point, to recognize that others are in no better position. 7. Does God exist? If God did not exist, it would be necessary for us to invent him. Voltaire. At long last I turn to the promised consideration of arguments for the existence of God. And having reviewed the obstacles, diplomatic, logical, psychological, and tactical, facing anybody who wants to do this constructively, I will give just a brief bird's-eye view of the domain of inquiry, expressing my own verdicts, but not the reasoning that has gone into them, and providing references to a few pieces that may not be familiar to many. There is a spectrum of intentional objects to consider, ranging along the anthropomorphism scale from a guy in the sky to one timeless, benign force or another. And there is a spectrum of arguments which line up only unevenly with the spectrum of gods. We can begin with anthropomorphic gods and the arguments from presumed historical documentation, such as this. According to the Bible, which is the literal truth, God exists, has always existed, and created the universe in 7 days a few thousand years ago. The historical arguments are apparently satisfying to those who accept them. But they simply cannot be introduced into a serious investigation, since they are manifestly question-begging. If this is not obvious to you, ask whether the Book of Mormon, 1829, or the founding document of Scientology, L. Ron Hubbard's book Dianetics, 1950, should be taken as irrefutable evidence for the propositions it contains. No text can be conceded the status of gospel truth without foreclosing all rational inquiry. That leaves us with the traditional arguments discussed at great length by the philosophers and theologians over the centuries, some empirical, such as the argument from design, and some purely a priori or logical, such as the ontological argument and the cosmological argument for the necessity of a first cause. The logical arguments are regarded by many thinkers, including many philosophers who have looked at them carefully for years, to be intellectual conjuring tricks or puzzles, rather than serious scientific proposals. Consider the ontological argument, first formulated by St. Anselm in the 11th century, as a direct response to Psalm chapter 14, verse 1, about what the fool said in his heart. If the fool understands the concept of God, Anselm claims, he should understand that God is, by definition, the greatest conceivable being, or, in a famously mind-twisting phrase, the being greater than which nothing can be conceived. But among the perfections such a greatest conceivable being would have to have is existence, since if God lacked existence, it would be possible to conceive of a still greater being, namely God with all his perfections, plus existence. A God that lacked existence would not be the being greater than which nothing can be conceived, but that is the definition of God, so therefore God must exist. Do you find this compelling? Or do you suspect it is some sort of logical trick with mirrors? Could you use the same argument scheme to prove the existence of the most perfect ice cream sundae conceivable? Since if it didn't exist, there would be a more perfect conceivable one, namely, one that did exist. If you're suspicious, you're in good company. Ever since Immanuel Kant in the 18th century, there has been a widespread, but by no means unanimous, conviction that you can't prove the existence of anything other than an abstraction by sheer logic. You can prove that there is a prime number larger than a trillion, and that there is a point at which the lines bisecting the three angles of any triangle all meet, and there is a Gödel sentence for every Turing machine that is consistent and can represent the truths of arithmetic. But you can't prove that something that has effects in the physical world exists, except by methods that are at least partly empirical. There are those who disagree and continue to champion updated versions of Anselm's ontological argument, but the price they pay, willingly, one gathers, for their access to purely logical proof, is a remarkably bare and featureless intentional object. Even if a being greater than which nothing can be conceived has to exist, as their arguments urge, it is a long haul from that specification to a being that is merciful or just or loving, unless you make sure to define it that way from the outset. Introducing anthropomorphism by a dodge that will not persuade the skeptics, needless to say. Nor, in my experience, does it reassure the faithful. The cosmological argument, which in its simplest form states that since everything must have a cause, the universe must have a cause, namely God, doesn't stay simple for long. Some deny the premise, since quantum physics teaches us, doesn't it, that not everything that happens needs to have a cause. Others prefer to accept the premise and then ask, what caused God? The reply that God is self-caused, somehow, then raises the rebuttal. If something can be self-caused, why can't the universe as a whole be the thing that is self-caused? This leads in various arcane directions into the strange precincts of string theory and probability fluctuations and the like at one extreme, and into ingenious nitpicking about the meaning of cause at the other. Unless you have a taste for mathematics and theoretical physics on the one hand, or the niceties of scholastic logic on the other, you are not apt to find any of this compelling, or even fathomable. Still, people may want to return to the a priori arguments as a safety net of sorts after they see what can be made of the empirical argument. The argument from design, including its recent variants invoking the anthropic principle. The argument from design is surely the most intuitive and popular argument, and has been for centuries. It just stands to reason, doesn't it, that all the wonders of the living world have to have been arranged by some intelligent designer. It couldn't all just be an accident, could it? And even if evolution by natural selection explains the design of living things, doesn't the fine-tuning of the laws of physics to make all this evolution possible require a tuner? The anthropic principle argument. No, it doesn't stand to reason, and yes, it could all just be the result of accidents exploited by the relentless regularities of nature. And no, the fine-tuning of the laws of physics can be explained without postulating an intelligent tuner. I have covered these arguments quite extensively in Darwin's Dangerous Idea, especially chapters 1 and 7. So I will repeat not my counter-arguments, but only my summary of the retreat that Darwin's Dangerous Idea has propelled during the last century and a half. We began with a somewhat childish vision of an anthropomorphic handicrafter god, and recognized that this idea, taken literally, was well on the road to extinction. When we looked through Darwin's eyes at the actual processes of design of which we and all the wonders of nature are the products to date, we found that Paley was right to see these effects as the result of a lot of design work. But we found a non-miraculous account of it, a massively parallel and hence prodigiously wasteful process of mindless, algorithmic design trying, in which, however the minimal increments of design have been thriftily husbanded, copied and reused over billions of years. The wonderful particularity or individuality of the creation was due, not to Shakespearean inventive genius, but to the incessant contributions of chance. A growing sequence of what Crick, 1968, has called frozen accidents. That vision of the creative process still apparently left a role for God as lawgiver. But this gave way in turn to the Newtonian role of lawfinder, which also evaporated, as we have recently seen, leaving behind no intelligent agency in the process at all. What is left is what the process, shuffling through eternity, mindlessly finds, when it finds anything, a timeless Platonic possibility of order. That is indeed a thing of beauty, as mathematicians are forever exclaiming, but it is not itself something intelligent, but, wonder of wonders, something intelligible. Being abstract and outside of time, it is nothing with an initiation or origin in need of explanation. What does need its origin explained is the concrete universe itself. And as Hume's Philo long ago asked, why not stop at the material world? It, we have seen, does perform a version of the ultimate bootstrapping trick. It creates itself ex nihilo, or at any rate out of something that is well-nigh indistinguishable from nothing at all. Unlike the puzzlingly mysterious timeless self-creation of God, this self-creation is a non-miraculous stunt that has left lots of traces. And being not just concrete, but the product of an exquisitely particular historical process, it is a creation of utter uniqueness, encompassing and dwarfing all the novels and paintings and symphonies of all the artists, occupying a position in the hyperspace of possibilities that differs from all others. Benedict Spinoza, in the 17th century, identified God and nature, arguing that scientific research was the true path of theology. For this heresy, he was persecuted. There is a troubling, or to some, enticing, Janus-faced quality to Spinoza's heretical vision of Deus sive natura, God or nature. In proposing his scientific simplification, was he personifying nature or depersonalizing God? Darwin's more generative vision provides the structure in which we can see the intelligence of Mother Nature. Or is it merely apparent intelligence as a non-miraculous and non-mysterious, and hence all the more wonderful, feature of this self-creating thing? Dennett, 1995b, pages 184-185. Should Spinoza be counted as an atheist or a pantheist? He saw the glory of nature and then saw a way of eliminating the middleman. As I said at the end of my earlier book, the tree of life is neither perfect nor infinite in space or time, but it is actual, and if it is not Anselm's being greater than which nothing can be conceived, it is surely a being that is greater than anything any of us will ever conceive of in detail worthy of its detail. Is something sacred? Yes, say I, with Nietzsche. I could not pray to it, but I can stand in affirmation of its magnificence. The world is sacred. 1995b, page 520. Does that make me an atheist? Certainly, in the obvious sense. If what you hold sacred is not any kind of person you could pray to, or consider to be an appropriate recipient of gratitude, or anger when a loved one is senselessly killed, you're an atheist in my book. If, for reasons of loyalty to tradition, diplomacy, or self-protective camouflage, very important today, especially for politicians, You want to deny what you are, that's your business, but don't kid yourself. Maybe in the future, if more of us brights will just come forward and calmly announce that of course we no longer believe in any of those gods, it will be possible to elect an atheist to some office higher than senator. We now have Jewish and female senators and homosexual members of Congress, so the future looks bright. So much for the belief in God. What about belief in God? We still haven't inquired about all the grounds for this belief in belief. Isn't it true? That is, isn't it true that, whether or not God exists, religious belief is at least as important as the belief in democracy, in the rule of law, in free will? The very widespread, but far from universal opinion, is that religion is the bulwark of morality and meaning. Without religion, we would fall into anarchy and chaos, in a world in which anything goes. The last five chapters have exposed a variety of familiar tricks that have been rediscovered over and over, and that tend to have the effect of protecting religious practices from extinction or erosion beyond recognition. If the grim side of this is the design of kleptocracies and other manifestly evil organizations that can prey on innocent people, the happy side is the design of humane and useful institutions that do not just deserve the loyalty of people, but can effectively secure it. We still have not seriously addressed the question of whether religions, some religions, one religion, any religion, are social phenomena that do more good than harm. Now that we can see through some of this protective gauze, we are in position to address that question. Chapter 8. The belief that belief in God is so important that it must not be subjected to the risks of disconfirmation or serious criticism has led the devout to save their beliefs by making them incomprehensible even to themselves. The result is that even the professors don't really know what they are professing. This makes the goal of either proving or disproving God's existence a quixotic quest, but also for that very reason, not very important. Chapter 9. The important question is whether religions deserve the continued protection of their adherents. Many people love their religions more than anything else in life. Do their religions deserve this adoration? Part 3. Religion Today. Chapter 9. Toward a Buyer's Guide to Religions. 1. For the Love of God. There is a state of mind, known to religious men but to no others, in which the will to assert ourselves and hold our own has been displaced by a willingness to close our mouths and be as nothing in the floods and waterspouts of God. In this state of mind, what we most dreaded has become the habitation of our safety, and the hour of our moral death has turned into our spiritual birthday. The time of tension in our soul is over, and that of happy relaxation, of calm, deep breathing, of an eternal present, with no discordant future to be anxious about, has arrived. William James, The Varieties of Religious Experience. Most people believe in the belief in God, even those who can't manage to believe in God all the time. Why do they believe this? An obvious answer is that they want to be good. That is, they want to lead good and meaningful lives, and they want this for others as well. And they can see no better way to do this than to put themselves in the service of God. This answer may be right. And they may be right, but before we can consider this answer with the care it deserves, we need to address a challenge. Some people, and you may be one of them, find this whole setting of the issue objectionable. I will let Professor Faith try to give a fair expression of this point of view. You insist on treating the question of religion as if it were like whether or not to switch jobs, or buy a car, or have an operation, a matter that ought to be settled by calmly and objectively considering the pros and cons, and then drawing a conclusion about the best course, all things considered. That's not how we see it at all. It isn't that belief in the belief in God is our settled conviction, a matter of the best overall life policy we have been able to discover. It goes way beyond that. In the previous chapter, you talked about fake it until you make it, but you never got around to describing the wonderful state of those who do make it, whose honest attempts to imbue themselves with the Spirit of God succeed in a burst of glory. Those of us who know the experience know that it is unlike any other experience, a joy warmer than the joy of motherhood, deeper than the joy of victory in sports, more ecstatic than the joys of playing or singing great music. When we see the light, it isn't just an aha experience, like figuring out a puzzle or suddenly seeing the hidden figure in a drawing or getting a joke or being persuaded by an argument. It isn't arriving at a belief at all. We know, then, that God is the greatest thing that could ever enter our lives. It isn't like accepting a conclusion. It's like falling in love. Yes, I hear you. I deliberately gave this chapter a provocative title to energize this concern and put this objection in the limelight. I recognize the state you're describing, and I would offer a friendly amendment. It isn't just like falling in love, it is a kind of falling in love. The discomfort or even outrage you feel when confronted by my calm invitation to consider the pros and cons of your religion is the same reaction one feels when asked for a candid evaluation of one's true love. I don't just like my darling because, after due considerations, I believe all her wonderful qualities far outweigh her few faults. I know that she is the one for me, and I will always love her with all my heart and soul. New England farmers are reputedly as tight-fisted with their emotions as they are with their wallets and their words. Here is an old Maine joke. How's your wife, Jeb? Compared to what? It would appear that Jeb is no longer in love with his wife. And if you are so much as willing to think about comparing your religion with others, or with having no religion at all, you must not be in love with your religion. This is a very personal love, not like the love of jazz or baseball or mountain scenery. But no single person, not the priest or the rabbi or the imam, or even any group of people, the congregation of the faithful, say, is the beloved. One's undying loyalty is not loyalty to them, singly or together, but to the system of ideas that unite them. Of course, people sometimes do fall in love, romantic love, with their priest or with a fellow parishioner. And this can be hard for them to distinguish from love of their religion, but I'm not suggesting that this is the nature of the love most God-loving people experience. I am suggesting, however, that their unquestioning loyalty, their unwillingness even to consider the virtues versus the vices, is a type of love, and more like romantic love than brotherly love or intellectual love. It is surely no accident that the language of romantic love and the language of religious devotion are all but indistinguishable, and it is similarly no accident that almost all religions, with a few austere exceptions such as the Puritans and the Shakers and the Taliban, have given their lovers a cornucopia of beauty to ravish their senses. Soaring architecture with decoration applied to every surface, music, candles, and incense. The inventory of the world's great works of art is crowned by religious masterpieces. Thanks to Islam, we have the Alhambra and the exquisite mosques of Isfahan and Istanbul. Thanks to Christianity, we have the Hagia Sophia and the cathedrals of Europe. You don't have to be a believer to be entranced by Buddhist, Hindu, and Shinto temples of surreal intricacy and sublime proportion. Bach's St. Matthew Passion and Handel's Messiah and those miniature marvels, the Christmas carols, are among the most rapturous love songs ever composed. And the stories they set to music are themselves compositions of extraordinary emotional power. The film director George Stevens may not have been exaggerating when he called his 1965 movie on the life of Jesus the greatest story ever told. The competition is fierce, what with the Odyssey, the Iliad, Robin Hood, Romeo and Juliet, Oliver Twist, Treasure Island, Huckleberry Finn, The Diary of Anne Frank, and all the other great narratives of the world's literature. But for joy, danger, pathos, triumph, tragedy, heroes and villains, but no comic relief, it is hard to beat. And, of course, the story has a moral. We love stories, and Elie Wiesel uses a story to explain this. When the founder of Hasidic Judaism, the great Rabbi Israel Shem Tov, saw misfortune threatening the Jews, it was his custom to go into a certain part of the forest to meditate. There he would light a fire, say a special prayer, and the miracle would be accomplished and the misfortune averted. Later, when his disciple, the celebrated Maggid of Meserich, had occasion for the same reason to intercede with heaven, He would go to the same place in the forest and say, "Master of the universe, listen. I do not know how to light the fire, but I am still able to say the prayer." And again the miracle would be accomplished. Still later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sasov, in order to save his people once more, would go into the forest and say, "I do not know how to light the fire. I do not know the prayer, but I know the place. And this must be sufficient." It was sufficient, and the miracle was accomplished. Then it fell to Rabbi Israel of Rizhin to overcome misfortune. Sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands, he spoke to God. "I am unable to light the fire, and I do not know the prayer, and I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is to tell the story, and this must be sufficient." And it was sufficient. For God made man because he loves stories. 1966 Preface. Not Wiesel, 1972, as many websites have it. We have been given a lot to love, and not just spectacularly beautiful art and stories and ceremonies. The daily actions of religious people have accomplished uncounted good deeds throughout history, alleviating suffering, feeding the hungry, caring for the sick. Religions have brought the comfort of belonging and companionship to many who would otherwise have passed through this life all alone, without glory or adventure. They have not just provided first aid, in effect, for people in difficulties. They have provided the means for changing the world in ways that remove those difficulties. As Alan Wolfe says, "Religion can lead people out of cycles of poverty and dependency, just as it led Moses out of Egypt." 2003, page 139. There is much for religion lovers to be proud of in their traditions, and much for all of us to be grateful for. The fact that so many people love their religions as much as or more than anything else in their lives is a weighty fact indeed. I am inclined to think that nothing could matter more than what people love. At any rate, I can think of no value that I would place higher. I would not want to live in a world without love. Would a world with peace but without love be a better world? Not if the peace was achieved by drugging the love and hate out of us or by suppression. Would a world with justice and freedom but without love be a better world? Not if it was achieved by somehow turning us all into loveless law-abiders, with none of the yearnings or envies or hatreds that are the wellsprings of injustice and subjugation. It is hard to consider such hypotheticals, and I doubt if we should trust our first intuitions about them. But for what it is worth, I surmise that we almost all want a world in which love, justice, freedom, and peace are all present as much as possible. But if we had to give up one of these, it wouldn't and shouldn't be love. But, sad to say, even if it is true that nothing could matter more than love, it wouldn't follow from this that we don't have reason to question the things that we and others love. Love is blind, as they say, and because love is blind, it often leads to tragedy, to conflicts in which one love is pitted against another love, and something has to give, with suffering guaranteed in any resolution. Suppose I love music more than life itself. Other things being equal, then, I should be free to live my life in pursuit of the exaltation of music, the thing I love most with all my heart and soul. But that still doesn't give me the right to force my children to practice their instruments night and day, or the right to impose musical education on everybody in the country of which I am the dictator, or to threaten the lives of those who have no love of music. If my love of music is so great that I am simply unable to consider its implications objectively, then this is an unfortunate disability. And others may, with good reason, assert the right to act as my surrogate, conscientiously deciding what is best for all, since my love has driven me mad, and I cannot rationally participate in the assessment of my own behavior and its consequences. There may well be nothing more wonderful than love, but love is not enough. A world in which baseball fans' love of their teams led them so to hate the other teams and their fans that murderous war accompanied the playoffs would be a world in which a particular love, pure and blameless in itself, led to immoral and intolerable consequences. So, although I understand and sympathize with those who take offense at my invitation to consider the pros and cons of religion, I insist that they have no right to indulge themselves by declaring their love and then hiding behind the veil of righteous indignation or hurt feelings. Love is not enough. Have you ever had to face the heart-wrenching problem of a dear friend who has fallen head over heels in love with somebody who is just not worthy of her love? If you suggest this to her, you risk losing a friend and getting slapped in the face for your trouble. For people in love often make it a point of honor to respond irrationally and violently to any perceived slight of their beloved. It's part of the whole point of being in love, after all. When they say that love is blind, they say it without regret. It is commonly understood that love should be blind. The whole idea of assessment should be off limits when it comes to true love. But why? Common wisdom doesn't answer, and hard-headed economists have long dismissed the idea as romantic nonsense. But the evolutionary economist Robert Frank has pointed out that there is, in fact, an excellent free-floating rationale for the phenomenon of romantic love in the unruly marketplace of human mate-finding. Because search is costly, it is rational to settle on a partner before having examined all potential candidates. Once a partner is chosen, however, the relevant circumstances will often change. The resulting uncertainty makes it imprudent to undertake joint investments that would otherwise be strongly in each party's interest. In order to facilitate these investments, each party wants to make a binding commitment to remain in the relationship. Objective personal characteristics may continue to play a role in determining which people are initially most attracted to one another, as much evidence suggests. But the poets are surely correct that the bond we call love does not consist of rational deliberations about these characteristics. It is instead an intrinsic bond, one in which the person is valued for his or her own sake. And precisely therein lies its value as a solution to the commitment problem. 1988, pages 195-196. As Steven Pinker says, "Murmuring that your lover's looks, earning power, and IQ meet your minimal standards would probably kill the romantic mood, even though the statement is statistically true. The way to a person's heart is to declare the opposite, that you're in love because you can't help it." 1997, page 418. This demonstrated, or at least passionately professed, helplessness is as close as you can muster to a guarantee that you are not still shopping around. Like all communicative signals, however, if it can be cheaply faked, your commitment signal will not be effective, and the result, as so often in the world of animal signaling, is the inflationary spiral of costly signaling. Zahavi, 1987. It is not just love-struck young men who shower their beloveds with presents they can barely afford. The bowerbirds' bowers are costly investments, and so are the nuptial gifts of food and other goods provided by male moths, beetles, crickets, and many other creatures. Has our evolved capacity for romantic love been exploited by religious memes? It would surely be a good trick. It would get people to think that it was actually honorable to take offense, to attack all skeptics with fury, to lash out wildly and without concern for their own safety, let alone the safety of the person they are attacking. Their beloved deserves nothing less than this, they think, a total commitment to eradicating the blasphemer. Of such stuff are fatwas made, but this meme is not at all restricted to Islam. There are plenty of misguided Christians, for instance, who will contemplate with relish the prospect of demonstrating the depths of their commitment by raining abuse on me for daring to question the love they have for their Jesus. Before they act on their self-indulgent fantasies, I hope they will pause to consider that any such action would actually bring dishonor to their faith. Some of the saddest spectacles of the last century have been the way zealots of all faiths and ethnicities have defiled their own shrines and holy places and brought shame and dishonor to their causes by their acts of fanatical loyalty. Kosovo may have been a holy place to Serbs since the Battle of 1389, but it is hard to see how Serbs can continue to cherish its memory after recent history. By destroying the idolatrous Buddhist monuments in Afghanistan, the Taliban dishonored themselves and their tradition in ways that will take centuries of good works to expiate. the killing of hundreds of Muslims in reprisal for the killing of dozens of Hindus in the Ashkardham temple in Gujarat, besmirches the reputations of both religions. Whose fanatical devotees should be reminded that the rest of the world is not just unmoved by, but sick and tired of their respective demonstrations of their devotion? What would really impress us infidels would be an announcement, unilateral or joint, that the contested site was henceforth to be considered the Hall of Shame, no longer holy, but rather a reminder to all of the evils of zealotry. Since September 11, 2001, I have often thought that perhaps it was fortunate for the world that the attackers targeted the World Trade Center instead of the Statue of Liberty. For if they had destroyed our sacred symbol of democracy, I fear that we Americans would have been unable to keep ourselves from indulging in paroxysms of revenge of a sort the world has never seen before. If that had happened, it would have befouled the meaning of the Statue of Liberty beyond any hope of subsequent redemption, if there were any people left to care. I have learned from my students that this upsetting thought of mine is subject to several unfortunate misconstruals, so let me expand on it to ward them off. The killing of thousands of innocents in the World Trade Center was a heinous crime, much more evil than the destruction of the Statue of Liberty would have been. And yes, the World Trade Center was a much more appropriate symbol of Al-Qaeda's wrath than the Statue of Liberty would have been. But for that very reason, it didn't mean as much as a symbol to us. It was mammon and plutocrats and globalization, not Lady Liberty. I do suspect that the fury with which many Americans would have responded to the unspeakable defilement of our cherished national symbol, the purest image of our aspirations as a democracy, would have made a sane and measured response extraordinarily difficult. This is the great danger of symbols. They can become too sacred. An important task for religious people of all faiths in the 21st century will be spreading the conviction that there are